You're listening to The Voice of Russia. I'm Tim Eckert, and today I'm in conversation with the journalist and author Peter Hitchens. Peter Hitchens is known for his polemical views, and his latest book is entitled The War We Never Fought: The British Establishment's Surrender to Drugs. In it, he argues that a progressively libertine mindset has created a society in which drug-taking is condoned, along with a host of other social ills that basically stem from a lack of discipline. I asked Peter Hitchens why he felt he needed to write this book.
Well, I partly feel it because I'm told constantly by reputable and clever people that there is such a war and that it's failing. And this, as you examine society around you, is so obviously untrue that I felt an urgent need to point out that it wasn't true, so that the debate which we have about drugs could at least be conducted on an intelligent level. There simply has not been any serious attempt, particularly to interdict demand for drugs, since the early 1970s. That means we've been undergoing in this country an experiment for 40 years, at least as radical as the one that's been going on in Amsterdam, but it's not been acknowledged. Here we have in this country more or less decriminalized several drugs, particularly cannabis. And we see, in my view, very baleful effects from that. And you might be able to draw the conclusion from that that perhaps decriminalization was a mistake. But if you continue to pretend that there is some kind of vicious, draconian, prohibitionary war against drug takers and drugs, then obviously you'll never be able to make sense of it.
But who is pretending that there is this draconian war against drugs? Because isn't the point of your book that the middle classes and, in fact, government have given up trying to even pretend that drugs are as serious a matter as you clearly believe
they
are?
Well, no, they haven't given up trying to pretend. They've given up trying to act on that view. A great deal of national debate in our country about drugs is premised on the idea that there is such a war, and it is factually demonstrable that there isn't one. So why are people saying this, and what can we do about it?
One of your theses in your book is that there's been this fatal distinction made between soft and hard drugs, and that cannabis in particular, which seems to occupy a large part of the book, should never have been classified as a soft drug. Why do you believe that so fervently?
Well, first of all, because of experiences that friends of mine have undergone involving their children, which suggests to me that there is such a strong correlation between the use of cannabis, particularly by the young, and irreversible mental illness, that you can't conceivably say that this is not a serious drug. Secondly, because I know it was the intention of the original campaigners for cannabis decriminalization back in the 1960s to separate cannabis from the other bogeyman drugs, such as heroin and cocaine and LSD. And the strange classification of drugs, which was included in the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971, was the fruit of that. And the main result of that, and it has no real scientific basis, I have no idea what objective calculus you could come up with which said drug A is more dangerous than drug B, since they all operate in very different ways. The whole effect of that has been to give cannabis a special status as class B or class C drug rather than class A, and as a soft drug. The very word soft is the key to the whole brilliant propaganda campaign that's been waged on behalf of this extremely dangerous drug. Now, obviously, if you took cocaine or heroin, you could do yourself very, very serious damage, and I wouldn't recommend them to anybody, and it would be much better if nobody took them. But the fact is, if you stopped taking them, you might have done yourself some physical harm, but at the end of it, you would still be more or less the same person you were when you started. If you took cannabis and you were one of those who went mad as a result, that would be the end of you. There is no coming back, and it seems to me that irreversible mental illness must be the most terrifying possible consequence of all. How you could decide that the drug which could conceivably put you in a locked ward for life was the least dangerous of the illegal drugs, I have no idea. It just seems to me not to make sense.
You point out very cogently in the book that if we look back at the hippie generation, the 60s, there were prominent people in the late 60s, early 70s, obviously the Beatles, but people like David Hockney, Graham Greene, David Dimbleby, who put their weight behind a campaign to decriminalise drugs. But the thesis behind that is that somehow, I think you even say, we live in an age when the British people have been led by a libertine and selfish middle class. And that's what you feel is that the root of this problem.
Very much so. The taking of drugs marches in step very much with the rest of the permissive society revolution. which is fundamentally a liberation of the self. The 20th century was the century of the self, and the 21st century promises to be more of the same, in which all the old restraints on personal behaviour were removed. You could do what you liked. The one and only commandment of the new godless religion is do what thou wilt. And, of course, putting substances into your own body which give you pleasure would form part of that, wouldn't it? The problem is that many of these people maintain this, that if it's a crime, it's a victimless crime. They have a right to do what they will with themselves. But most people are loved by somebody else. And what they do to themselves, if it causes lasting damage and makes them a burden and turns them into a disaster, has huge effects on other people.
For you, this is a moral question, that the lack of self-restraint brings harm to others.
Oh, very much so. For me, it's a moral question, but then it's difficult for me because I embrace a moral system which most people have abandoned. So I have to come up with...
Which is what?
Which is Christianity. But I have to come up with utilitarian arguments to back up what I say. It's actually almost invariably the case that Christian arguments can easily be backed up by utilitarian arguments, because if you abandon Christianity, you generally find you've exposed yourself to grave dangers against which it does, as it happens, protect you. But I have to pursue this argument on two fronts. To those who are interested in morals, I'll say that it seems to me to be perfectly obvious that stupefying yourself is wrong. It's a throwing away of the gifts that have been given to you. But if that doesn't do anything for you, then I will say, all right, well, what about if you take this, it'll make you go mad? Both of them seem to me to be quite powerful arguments.
But most of the people, prominent people who publicly admitted, at least at some stage, dabbling in what they call soft drugs, would say, it hasn't generally done me any lasting harm. Why do you feel the need to tell them that they should never have done it in the first place?
Well, first of all, it may be true that it hasn't done them any lasting harm, though how do we know? How do we know how much cleverer and more successful they might have been if they hadn't taken it? And how do we know about the details of their private lives? And indeed, their lives are not at an end yet. I do wonder sometimes whether this terrible epidemic of dementia and Alzheimer's, which besets the ends of all our lives in the modern world, may have something to do with our increased willingness to take drugs during our healthy lives. And there are all kinds of other consequences, I think. So let's not be too sure about how it hasn't done them any harm. But if it hasn't done them any harm, then that's their good fortune, because it could have done them grave harm. And if it remains legal and if effectively decriminalized, and if its use becomes more common, then other people will come to harm as a result of it. Now, is it an unselfish or indeed responsible act to campaign for the decriminalization of a drug for your own convenience, knowing perfectly well that as a result of that decriminalization, somebody somewhere else will suffer? This is the old conundrum in The Third Man, where Orson Welles says to Holly Martin, if you could, by pressing a button on a machine, kill a man in China thousands of miles away whom you never knew and be paid $100 for it, would you do it? Many people would, but if you really know and understand that your pleasure is costing the life or happiness of somebody else, can you really morally do it? Can you look yourself in the mirror and say, my pleasure is actually worth the destruction which it might well visit on somebody else's life and family?
I mean, that's a deep moral and philosophical question. If you don't mind me saying so, Peter, you are of the Beatles generation yourself. Did you ever feel the need or the desire to experiment with drugs in your own youth?
Well, I wouldn't have dignified it with the word experiment. I did attempt to take drugs. Fortunately, as a non-smoker, it had so little effect on me that I thought that let's not bother this again. But I look upon it as someone who walked in the middle of the night along a narrow precipice because I was stupid, irresponsible, and selfish. And it's an unforgivable action.
And you would now say that anyone who takes cannabis is stupid, arrogant, and selfish?
Yes, I think that it's even worse now because we know so much more about it than we did then. As I point out in the book, they only very recently isolated its principles. Active ingredients in 1971.
But people do lots of things that are bad for them. Why do you feel this need to crusade particularly against cannabis? I know you've said there are tragic consequences for some individuals, but there seems to be a lot of people who do it who we don't see murdering other people or becoming schizophrenic.
Well, I don't know about murder and schizophrenia. I mean, there's no need to set up enormous great bogeymen to say this thing is damaging. We recently had, and this is particularly interesting because mental health is not generally objectively definable. when you say someone has schizophrenia, you're using a set of subjective characteristics. When you say someone has emphysema or a degenerative heart disease or lung cancer, then you can point to something specific, measurable, and material that they have. But recently we had this Dunedin cohort who was surveyed for cannabis use, and it was found that the intelligence of the people involved when they'd taken it in their teens measurably decreased. That seems to me to be a very, very serious thing to happen to somebody, that an avoidable decrease in intelligence, which you have inflicted on yourself by taking a drug. Now, any drug which is on commercial sale, which was shown to decrease intelligence, would immediately be taken off the market. I mean, howls of execration from everybody. How dare these exploitative big pharmaceutical companies risk the intelligence of so many people with this irresponsible drug? But cannabis, for some reason, has such a fantastic public relations campaign behind it all the time that it can do this thing, and people still say it's cool.
One of the things you say relatively late on in the book is that cannabis smoking has become so common in the political and media classes that the most influential people in this country are prejudiced, corrupted, and embarrassed by it. Can you explain that?
I think it is invariably true that if someone is faced with a moral question in a public place and can influence the way in which it's handled, his or her own conscience will affect the way they do it. So if you're sitting in a radio or television studio and you're planning a program about cannabis and you yourself are a cannabis user, or you allow your children to use cannabis, you are going to be defensive for two reasons. One, because you think that what you're doing is all right. Two, because you're afraid that if you become persuaded by the arguments against it, you condemn it, you are then open to a form of blackmail. People can turn around and say, well, it's all very well him saying that, but he has, did, on an occasion known to me, take this drug against which he's now campaigning. I think a lot of politicians are corrupted by this. It's a different form of corruption.
But you seem to be suggesting that there's a whole class, and they're the people who make the big decisions
widespread
in this country, who have taken this drug and whose children persist in taking it, that they simply dare not oppose it.
They dare not, and also they don't want to.
Because they've lost their moral way, in your view?
I think it's part of... When you have a revolution, one of the things you like to do is to get the revolutionary mob to dip their hands in the blood so that there's no way back for them. And that's what revolutionaries like to do. They like to make sure that their supporters are implicated in whatever it is that's being done. And a very significant part, a very significant rite of initiation into the modern Western Cultural Revolution was illegal drug taking. And it gets you, it takes you over onto the other side. Unless you're prepared to say, as I do, this is something which I profoundly regret and which is utterly wrong, which people often aren't prepared to say about their past lives, then you're implicated ever thereafter. You've dipped your hands in the blood. You're one of them. You've crossed over.
There is a wider subtext to your book, I would suggest, that you see this relationship to cannabis, which seems to be so pervasive in your view at all levels of society, but particularly among the intelligentsia, that this is symptomatic of Britain's moral decline in the way the country, in your view, has lost its way.
Oh, it certainly has an effect on it, yes. But this country, the civilization in which we live, was formed by Protestant Christianity, and much of the supposed philosophy and thinking of all kinds, cultural, artistic, musical, literary, of the past century has been a revolt against Protestant Christianity, as Protestant Christianity has weakened and died in this country. It doesn't really have a positive positive aim or intent. It's not a revolutionary conspiracy to create a certain kind of country. What it is a very strong desire to get rid of the remaining restraints of Protestant Christianity and turn us into a post-Christian society. And I think you can see that in common in so much of it, particularly in the writings of people like Anthony Crossland and to some extent of Roy Jenkins, who were the progenitors of the political side of this revolution in the 1950s and 1960s.
You lay a lot of the blame for this post-Christian society at Labour or the left's door, but you also excoriate the Conservative Party in its modern form as being part of that whole conspiracy.
Well, there's no conspiracy, as I say. I don't believe there's a conspiracy. What the Conservative Party has done is the Conservative Party is fundamentally a machine for winning office for the sons of gentlemen. It has no dogma. It has no. It calls itself a Conservative Party. It's not particularly conservative. It's not the Labour Party. That's its only actually conservative element.
Has it lost its way, or did it
never
have
a way?
And
because it never had a way, and because it never understood. I'm a former revolutionary Marxist, so I understand what Marxists want, what they do, what they say in private, what they really hate, what they really like, in a way that most conservatives don't have a clue about. It's all very well not having a dogma. I'm in favour of that. Dogmas often turn people into murderers. But it is essential, if you're dealing with someone who does have a dogma, to understand it and to see the significance of the actions which they pursue and the desires which they have. Conservatism accepts and absorbs and in the end, as a result, endorses a lot of the things which the left has campaigned for. And as a result, it becomes an instrument of the left, unwittingly and passively rather than actively.
Didn't Margaret Thatcher have a dogma?
If she did, it was that of classical liberalism. She was economically and socially liberal. There's no evidence that I can see from her time in office of any serious action for cultural or moral or social conservatism.
This is The Voice of Russia. I'm Tim Eckott, and I'm in conversation with the author, Peter Hitchens. You've jokingly accepted, I gather, the label of Puritan. You sometimes call yourself...
No, jokingly.
You're happy to be called a new Puritan.
I don't mind that at all. I suspect that some of my ancestors were Ironsides. I very much hope that they were. And I've always thought that the Ironsides had a point. I do see a lot of admirable qualities in the Puritans. And I think there's a very interesting thing about the free societies on the planet. If you look at them, they are almost all based upon a pretty stern version of Protestant Christianity.
But isn't being a new Puritan, if we can coin that term, isn't that dogmatic in itself?
I don't think so, no. Not in political terms. I mean, it bases itself on some religious dogmas, but as far as I'm concerned, the whole religious concept of sin, grace, and forgiveness are for the individual. They're not for me to try and impose them on somebody else. All I would do in intervening in politics is to try and stop the state interfering between people in their consciences, which I believe it does at the moment, by making it much more difficult for people to act freely according to their consciences. I think that has been the effect of the state's intervention in British life over much of the past century, is to make a conscience-ruled life much more difficult.
But without a strong cultural and educational tradition, and that's one of the things you seem to be saying in this book and in other fora, is missing from modern British life, don't you need someone at the top of society to say, this is right, this is wrong?
Well, you can certainly do that, and in a free society you have laws which are agreed upon and accepted and enforced, and which apply to the powerful as well to the weak, and that's quite different from saying, what are you saying when you say there should be an enforced law against cannabis possession? Are you saying the police should be smashing down every front door searching the house for cannabis? No, you're not. All criminal justice is essentially street theatre. What you're saying is that it should be made clear that if somebody is caught in possession of cannabis, then they will be exposed to the punishment of the criminal law. Myself, I would say, first offence of a juvenile, a warning, but a genuine warning, not the kind of warning that's given now, which leads to another warning and another warning and another warning, but a genuine warning: you do this again, you'll be severely punished. And the second offence should therefore be the one where someone actually comes up against severe punishment in quite a shocking fashion. My main purpose of what I seek is actually to fight against the horrible peer pressure which the young experience, particularly in schools, to start taking drugs.
You blame teachers and parents for lacking the moral fibre, if I can use that old-fashioned phrase, to actually show children that drug-taking is simply not a good option.
Well, if there is a teacher and if there is a parent who has that moral fibre, he or she is left standing on her own, because the whole background noise from the state and websites such as Talk to Frank, which seems to suggest that there are safe ways of taking drugs, and from the media, which constantly suggests that there is this terrible war against drugs, which is iniquitous, and the behaviour of many, many prominent people in public life who pretty much openly let it be known that they take drugs and that they're keen on it, and who, in the case of rock music, advertise drugs in their lyrics. Against that, what's one parent and one teacher? What you need is for the state and for what you might call the establishment to be on the same side as the parent. If you are a parent to whom this disaster has happened, you feel completely abandoned.
But come on, most schools will still expel pupils caught taking drugs.
Will they?
in my experience.
I'd love to know what the basis of that information is.
Well, I have children at secondary school. To my knowledge, they've never taken drugs. They're not encouraged to take drugs. They don't have parents who take drugs. I have many friends whose children, I think, are given the same moral guidance. And in their schools, both state and private, taking drugs is regarded as an expelling offence.
Well, I'm lucky you, is all I can say. I don't think that in large parts of the country that is the case. And I know that I won't name the town because it's probably a bad idea to do so. I was speaking on this subject in a Sussex town a few months ago, and a woman stood up back and said, well, what am I to do? Every day, drugs are sold openly at the gate of my child's secondary school. I've called the police. They went round once, did nothing, and haven't come back. They're not interested. And but I think that's much more typical of the experience of parents in modern Britain, that drugs are sold openly at the gates of these schools, often at lunchtime, and nothing is done about it because the police are not interested. Why would the police be interested? What's in it for them? Why bother arresting people who, if you can get the Crown Prosecution Service to act against, will not be penalised in any serious fashion? It's a waste of your time.
How much has your own Christian faith informed this argument?
Oh, I've been engaging in one form of this argument or another since, well, I wrote my first book, The Abolition of Britain, more than 10 years ago now, and each of the books that I've written since has been, in a way, a supplement to that. The more I've written about it, the more it seemed to me that the decline and decay of Christianity in this country is fundamental to an understanding and explanation of what's going on. For a long time, I sought some sort of text which might have been the original manifesto of the people who've done so much to wreck the country, as if they might have had a positive plan. But I don't believe there is any such text now, any more than you can project black light, or any more than cold will radiate. What we have is an increasing absence of a conscience-run society.
So was their text, in effect, their godlessness?
I think that's putting it too specifically. I think the withdrawal, the long withdrawing roar of the Sea of Faith was the background to what happened. When that happens, people do become more selfish. And as they become more selfish, they prefer the society around them to endorse their selfishness rather than to disapprove of it or to punish it.
Most people see the lack of the influence of the church and the enforced Christianity of the old order, those things being removed, as a positive step, because they say we're now all free to choose whether we believe or don't believe, and we don't want the church telling us what we should and shouldn't do.
Well, they're right in a sense. You must choose. There is no such thing as a perfect society on earth. The society which I would like would be regarded by many people brought up in the modern world as very restrictive. On the other hand, I would say that most of the people who take part in this debate are very fortunate. They're generally quite well off, rich, live in comfortable, pleasant areas of the country, and are able to escape the worst consequences of it.
What would you say to those people who have what you might call a more liberal attitude to cannabis taking, who will accuse you of being A, moralising, B, old-fashioned, and intolerant?
Well, I don't care if anybody wants to call me old-fashioned. Then that's fine by me. It's a compliment. And moralising, well, if you believe that there is a moral law, then you would be failing in your duty if you didn't try and persuade other people to adopt it. After all, if you're me, you think, amongst other things, your immortal soul is at stake there. So to do nothing about it would be feeble and irresponsible. I'm sorry, what was the third thing they would accuse me of?
Intolerant.
Intolerant. Well, I don't know. I'm tolerant of all kinds of things. You have to be, but tolerance actually implies disapproval. Tolerance is putting up with things you don't like.
But do you see drug takers as weak?
I don't think it's as simple as that. We all have our weaknesses. I mean, I like food too much, and I eat too much. I have a constant struggle against getting too fat, and it's no good going around committing the ones you're inclined to.
I mean, you're obviously winning that struggle, though.
No, it's nice of you to say so, but it's, my point is this. You know, I have failings of my own. I give in to these failings and weaknesses more than I should, so I'm not lecturing other people on how to be perfect.
But you do say, I mean, for example, you even have a swipe at things like dyslexia. dyslexia and ADHD, you imply that those are not real illnesses and that they're sort of...
I don't imply they're not real illnesses. They simply aren't. And you just use the scientific method. Where is the objective test for the presence of either of these ailments in the human body? There isn't one.
Are you implying that those are in some sense a moral weakness if you say your kid
has
got
weakness.
Those things?
And I think what is happening with things like ADHD and dyslexia is the making of excuses. Now, I wouldn't, in the case of dyslexia, the making of excuses to the fact that we have abandoned simple, well-known and long-tried means of teaching children to read because we regard them as authoritarian and won't use them. And then we try and classify the consequences of this as some kind of disease. In the case of ADHD, it's a consequence of several things: bad upbringing by parents, extraordinarily bad schools, very boring schools. I wouldn't mind so much about ADHD if it were treated by Indian head massage or having your chakras felt or lighting candles or some sort of hypnotherapy. That would be ludicrous but harmless. But this alleged disorder, which has no objective characteristics, is treated by the ingestion of an enormously powerful chemical, which alters the human mind. And I just don't think you can justify such an amazingly radical, dangerous, unproven, risky action on the basis of a complaint whose existence cannot be objectively demonstrated in the human frame. It just seems to me to be utterly irresponsible.
Has Britain gone to the dogs? Are we going to hell in a handcart?
Well, people use these phrases. I don't think they're of any help to anybody. I think that we have decided as a culture and a civilization to commit national suicide.
Why would a culture do that?
Oh, because it's pleasant and agreeable at the time. The descent into hell has always been easy, hasn't it? The broad path which leads to destruction has always been the broad path to destruction. It's the straight and narrow way has been the route to salvation. It's always been difficult to maintain a civilization and involved an awful lot of self-discipline and sacrifice. I think people know this instinctively. But if you prefer the primrose path to the eternal bonfire, then you'll have a lot of fun on the way. But at the end of it, you'll get the consequences. If people wish to join the third world in this country, and I think quite a lot of people more or less do because they think that kind of way of life is more relaxed and more enjoyable, they're going to have to understand that there are consequences, that people who live in the third world pay a very heavy price for living more relaxed lives.
What kind of world what kind of Britain will your grandchildren live in?
Well, I hope that they will have emigrated before it comes about. Because I think it would be chaotic, incompetent, slovenly, dangerous, disease-ridden, economically backward, ugly, and generally disagreeable. The life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, British, and short. I think that's what we're aiming for, and if you aim for it hard enough, you'll get it.
Peter, we could talk for a long time about this, but that's probably a very neat way to end our conversation. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
That was the author Peter Hitchens talking about his latest book, The War We Never Fought, The British Establishment's Surrender to Drugs. I'm Tim Eckott, and you've been listening to In Conversation.